Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Republican Steve Negron is an Air Force veteran and former state House lawmaker who hopes to challenge incumbent Democrat Annie Custer in New Hampshire's 2nd Congressional District. Today on the program, a conversation with him about why he thinks he's the candidate best equipped to beat Custer. And later in the program, we'll speak with Republican Matt Mayberry about his bid for his party's nomination to face Congressman Chris Pappas in New Hampshire's 1st Congressional District. You can send your questions for either candidate now. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. And with me now is Steve Negron. Thank you very much for being on the program today.
Good morning, Peter. Thank you very much for having me.
So you challenged Annie Custer and lost in 2018. So what has changed about your campaign that you think makes you more competitive this time around?
Well, sure. It's very simple. There's a couple of things that we've reassessed after the last time. Name recognition in the 2nd Congressional District is always a big deal. We came out last time out of a 7-way competitive Republican primary, and we didn't have name recognition. We did take 117,990 votes last time in a midterm, and that's the most votes a Republican has gotten in a midterm since 2002. So what we're seeing right now is that our name recognition is where we left off. Peter, and I think that's important. People understand the name, they know the name. And when we were talking to people, as we still currently do around the district, it is a huge hurdle that we don't have to address as much this time. And I think that's gonna be a huge advantage for us going into this cycle.
What about policy positions? Have any evolved or changed since 2018?
Not necessarily. One of the things that we do here when we're knocking on doors right now is nobody really wants to talk about those things that were big issues last time. What people are talking about right now, Peter, is that, nobody wants their town or their hamlet or their city to be a Portland, Oregon, or, a Seattle, Washington. That's the thing that's resonating with people. And certainly then, this COVID pandemic that we've experienced, those are the things that have people bending my ear about, what are we doing? How is it going to be different? And so those are the kind of issues that we're talking about primarily on the phone.
Well, let's talk about a few of those issues with respect to COVID-19. What more do you think Congress should be doing to address it?
Well, sure. Well, the first thing Congress should be doing is not spend as much money as they've spent to date. One of the things, when you look at some of these bills that came out, especially the first one, I personally believe that there was a lot of money that was actually put in there that really was not quite required for the pandemic.
For example?
So you looked at, you had some money in there for a performing center that was there. And the irony about that is that, the money gets to the performing center, but nobody can go to it. So, it should have been a very simple litmus test. If it doesn't directly go to something that's affected by COVID-19, it shouldn't be in there.
Are you saying, though, that businesses like the performing arts are not affected by the COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, certainly the business itself, no. Some of the people that are—
It's not, even though people can't, even though, wait, people, even though people can't go to a theater because of the pandemic, the theater is not itself affected by the pandemic?
Well, the theater is affected by the pandemic because of our overreaction to the situation, where people are not allowed to go to a situation or to a theater to enjoy themselves. So I think it's the reaction to the pandemic that actually affected the theater, not the pandemic.
So are you saying not allowing large numbers of people to gather in small enclosed spaces is an overreaction to an airborne illness that's killed more than 170,000 people?
Well, I think, Peter, that's a discussion probably for another day. But yes, the point is, you can limit, you can do some things that are out there. But one of the things that, when we made these decisions, we didn't know a lot about this pandemic. We know a lot more about this pandemic. And so I think we should have adjusted what we were doing. But you look at some of the spending that came in that bill, and I personally believe that there was a lot of stuff that wasn't required that was put in there.
Okay. And so do you approve of the way President Trump has handled the crisis?
Yes, I do. You know, I believe that what we have right now was, you know, early on, and it was unfortunate that when the president was actually restricting flights in from China, they were actually signing articles of impeachment. So look, as you go down the road and you get smarter, you adjust your approach. And I think the president, based on the information that he was given, is doing as good a job as anybody that could have done it in the White House.
Mm-hmm. Regarding spending levels, even before the pandemic began, President Trump's tax cuts ballooned the deficit, ballooned the debt. And this was before pandemic spending happened.
Right.
Do you approve of those tax cuts from a fiscal policy position?
I approve of the tax cuts, but I got to tell you, Peter, that with tax cuts, you have to do debt reduction. Those things have to go hand in hand. I know that the president was trying to do those. I don't think we've moved as far as we needed to. The tax cuts were important to middle class, but I personally didn't see a lot of debt reduction that was happening in parallel to that. And I believe that's something that has to happen. You have a tax break, you have to have debt reduction at the same time.
Mm-hmm. So aside from COVID spending, which you feel like in some areas needs to be reined in, are there any other areas of spending reduction that you would like to see and that you would advocate for in Congress?
Oh, absolutely. I think that, you know, our spending is out of control. I think that everything is on the table. You know, my company does primarily DOD work. I believe that there is a way to be able to be more efficient with the money that we have. And that goes across all the departments in the government. I think our government is too big. It's too bloated. And I think we have to be able to rein this stuff in. You know, we're at $26 trillion and counting. We have to be able to rein that in. If not, then the country that we've grown to love and appreciate is not going to be there for our children or our children's children.
Listeners, if you've got questions for Republican Steve Negron as he runs for Congress in New Hampshire's 2nd District, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. Steve Negron, you're from Nashua, the most diverse city in New Hampshire.
Yes.
What steps would you take in Congress to address racial injustice on behalf of your constituents?
Well, sure. Well, that's an interesting topic. And being the only minority and being 100% Hispanic in this race, you know, I have a perspective that most people who talk about racial injustice do not. Look, there are going to be in situations where we have bad people doing bad things, you know, but to make this as an indictment against our country, I think is a bit far reaching and really not well founded.
I'm sorry, I don't understand. What indictment are you referring to?
So you talk about, you know, your situation, what happened in Minneapolis when you had Mr. Floyd, and all of a sudden there's an indictment that there's this prevailing social and racial injustice that's happened across this country. And when I talk about that, and I've been asked about that a lot because of my perspective, is that absolutely, there are those situations, sir, where there are people that are gonna do some things based on race or color, which are wrong. But I don't believe this country is in a situation where it's this prevailing feeling. You know, I was just at an event last night, and for me, the litmus test is, you know, are we better than we were in 1960? Absolutely. Are we perfect? No, we're not. Is there always place and room for improvement? Yes, and those people should be heard because they also have a voice. But it isn't a situation where we're seeing across this country where we see towns like Portland and Seattle, and then what happened in Wisconsin. I think that's not the way to be able to adjust this, and I think people need to understand that if somebody has an issue, we need to be able to listen to it.
So just to put a fine point on it, do you believe there are areas of systemic racism inside the federal government or inside American society at large that
no,
need to be addressed?
No, I reject the notion of systemic racism. I will tell you that there are.
Well, what about redlining, though? The federal policies that prohibited black and brown families from buying properties in certain areas that led to generations of wealth inequality. That's a federal policy.
Are you saying there's a redlining policy today that exists?
No, not today. I'm referring to generations ago where it cascades over decades.
Sure. I mean, we can go back and try to pin the sins of my father on me. But the issue is, you know, you have to ask your question, are we better today? If the answer is yes, then I think we're making progress. You know, we can go back into history and look at all the bad decisions that were made and all of a sudden try to make it to a point that is affecting us right now. What I respectfully suggest is that we know that there's places that we can improve, sir, and that's what we're trying to do.
So what are those places and how would you work to improve them?
Sure, absolutely. I think that everybody has an opportunity to make their own way in this country. I believe that everybody's responsible for each other. For themselves. You know, it shouldn't be about the government giving me a situation over one or another because of color. Look, we're all created equal. I firmly believe that. I believe the Constitution provides for those provisions that everybody is equal. When we find areas where they're not equal, we need to go ahead and adjust those. If there's companies that have bad hiring practices, you know, and it's legitimate, then we need to address those. But it isn't something that is prevailing over this country. And look, you know, as a Hispanic, you know, I had some situations growing up where I was not allowed and I was not given access to some things. But I chose not to be a victim. I chose to be able to take that and learn from it and make myself better. And I'm here on the New Hampshire Public Radio talk show as a candidate for the United States Congress as 100% Hispanic. So I think we've done some great things over the last couple of decades.
I want to ask you a little bit about healthcare policy and transition here. You've said that the cost of healthcare is one of your highest priorities. You've also said the Affordable Care Act should be repealed. Given that COVID-19 has disproportionately impacted Black and brown people in this country, the same people whose access to healthcare has been improved most under the ACA, how would you address this disparity?
Sure. Well, let's go prior to COVID-19. You know, we had the lowest unemployment rate. We had the most jobs that are out there for both Blacks and Browns and Hispanics. We were going along. We were doing very well. The issue with healthcare is that it has to be affordable and accessible. And I believe there's some things out now that are preventing that. I believe in our great state right now, you know, we need access to more providers. We need to bring down barriers to entry so that other people can come in. And that we as a consumer, we need to be able to do competitive shopping and comparative shopping just like we do for everything else. You know, I can go and find a different company for my boat insurance and my house insurance and my car insurance. But somehow, right now, we are precluded from doing that in the current healthcare state, and we need to bring down those barriers to entry. I believe that transparency and cost, you know, we all get an explanation of benefits, and we see that an MRI costs $3,500, as an example. When I know that I can go and get that same procedure, probably with the same equipment and probably the same technicians for $500 or $700, you need to empower the consumer. This is no different. I think government needs to get out of the business of healthcare. Give me the consumer the opportunity to make those decisions on my own. And I think that's how we're going to bring down the healthcare and affordability and accessibility to this country.
Do you support the provisions of the Affordable Care Act that allow people up to the age of 26, for example, to stay on their parents' health insurance, and also the provision that prevents companies from denying people because of pre-existing conditions? Do you support those?
Sure. I'll take the second one. I believe that nobody should be excluded about pre-existing conditions. And look, the thing about the 26-year-old, I have three children all over the age of 21. They all have their own health care. You know, I believe what happens when you allow a child to stay on to 26, in my opinion, as a father, it's not the incentive for me to go out. Look, I started my health care when I was 22, as soon as I got out of college. I think you minimize the effect of a child trying to go out on their own. That's something that I would look at. I'll be honest with you. I'm not a fan of keeping kids until 26.
Mm-hmm. We get this question from Liza in Claremont. Liza asks, does the candidate support a woman's right to make her own health care decisions?
Sure, absolutely. You know, they can go to whatever doctor they want. They can go whatever OBGYN they want. They shouldn't be told what person or what doctor they need to go to. So in the spirit of health care, absolutely, they should be able to make that decision just like I do. When I go to whatever dentist I want or whatever, you know, chiropractor I want, that's my decision as an individual. And I should have every right for healthcare to be able to go and seek whatever provider I see fit for me or my family.
Do you support a woman's right to choose to have an abortion?
No, I do not.
Mm-hmm. Paul in Plymouth wanted to know about the Affordable Care Act, your position on it. You've made clear that you don't support it, but what would you replace it with, if anything?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'd get the government out of healthcare, and I would look at the open market, and I would look at those things we talked about earlier, Peter, about bringing down the cost, bringing down accessibility, opening up barriers to entry to bring people in, giving you insight and transparency into the cost, and give you an opportunity as a consumer to be able to make that decision. You know, I shouldn't be told these are my only options. We do it in everything else we do. I believe you have to have the ability to do what's right for you and your family, and that's just going to be transparency.
Listeners, there's still time for you to get a question for Steve Negron, who is running for Congress in the Republican primary for New Hampshire's 2nd Congressional District. Our number, 1-800-892-3600. 6477 or email exchange at nhpr.org. Angela wrote in. She has this question. What is the middle class tax break that we got from this administration? Who actually benefited from this administration's tax cut?
Well, I can tell you there's many families that I talk in New Hampshire. You're looking at about $1,200 extra in their paycheck. Me as a business owner.
Was that the tax cut or was that a COVID-19 stimulus?
No. This was the tax cut that was done in 2017. If that's what she's talking about.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think she was referring to the tax cuts passed a couple of years ago, well before
right.
the COVID-19 outbreak.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, let's tackle another question because there are a few issues we want to get into. With respect to immigration policy, on your campaign website, you say that, quote, the Pelosi-Custer agenda limits law enforcement and expands risk to public safety. What specific policy does that?
When you limit the effect of federal agencies not on the border to actually do their job, to apprehend illegal immigrants that are coming here. Now, I don't know if you know, Peter, my grandfather came here from Mexico in 1921. He immigrated into this country. And there's a sense of pride. And I'm just only going to speak from my family's perspective and a lot of the Hispanics that I know to come to this country and to be a contributing citizen. You know, everybody wants to talk about citizenship, but there's like 168 ways to come into this country with visas and work visas and those kind of things. I think we need to allow those people that follow the rule. We are a land of laws. There's a right way to do it. We need to get back to doing those things. And I think what we've seen from the Custer-Pelosi agenda, they don't want to actually do that. They believe that for whatever reason, which I don't fully understand, that open borders is something that they would want. That's not what I'm about. I don't believe that. I believe that we have a responsibility to keep our country safe. There are people that come across this border. Nobody wants to talk about human trafficking, which is another issue. But when you shackle and handcuff law enforcement to be able to do their jobs, which I believe Pelosi and Custer have done a lot, I think you're putting a lot of the citizens in this country at risk and preventing, quite frankly, some good folks that want to come here legally from coming into the country.
A variety of studies have shown that immigrants, even those who are undocumented, make massive contributions to the U.S. economy and over time actually pay more in taxes than they draw in benefits. You've been against illegal immigration, but in your view, is there not an incentive to make it easier for people to legally immigrate here? Is that, in your view, an incentive that the government should put in place, making it easier for people to legally immigrate here?
Sure. I think anything, you know, as long as we're following the law and we're allowing people to come into this country and everybody understands what the requirements are, you know, that's talking about people that are bilingual at the border to be able to have people understand what's required. I think we have to talk to a lot of the countries south of us that are bringing, I mean, people immigrate from here from all over the world, not just from Mexico and through Central America. But I think the countries that we need to talk to need to understand what is required to come to the state. What happens if you come into the country illegally? And I think that's a lot of people. Yes, absolutely. Are there people that are productive? You bet. But it doesn't mean that you can usurp the law. We have a process by which we have to come into this country. We should follow it.
Mm-hmm. But so what about changing the law to make it easier so that some of those perhaps who found it too difficult to immigrate under the current legal system to maybe participate in a legal way? Is there a way to make
Absolutely.
It easier? And
right.
what is
that's
that way?
That's a great point. Yes, sir. I think that the immigration policy needs to be looked at from top to bottom. The visa process needs to be looked at top to bottom. But when the dust settles and the smoke clears, whatever the law is, anybody trying to come into this country must comply with those laws or they don't get access to entry.
So what about the visa program, for example, do you think needs to be looked at and possibly changed?
Sure. One of the ones, you know, and I had a lot of small business guys talk to me about, you know, they have the work visas or the temporary work visas that were capped at 30,000. I believe we need to look at if you've already been approved once for seasonal work, then you have a situation where you're like in a pool of people that are, for lack of a better term, pre-approved, and you get to come into the country. You know, they capped it, and that really hurt a lot of people, landscapers, folks that have small businesses like Dunkin' Donuts. I think that we limited the effect, but my real concern is understanding who fundamentally is in our country, what are they here for? And I think if you've already passed the process once, then you're in a special category, if you will. You still have to apply, but you're not counted against all the new people that are trying to come in. So I think there's some ways that we can make it better, more efficient, and because they want to come here, they want to work. They want to earn a living to send back to their families. And I know a lot of them. You know, my landscaping company, the young man who owns the company I deal with is a former Eagle Scout of mine. And the people that come here, I've known them for 3, 4, 5 years. They're great. They're hardworking people. They want to come here. They want to earn a living, and then they want to go back. And so I believe that there's some ways that we can help alleviate that, not only for them, but some of the small businesses in our state.
What about refugees, a particular kind of immigrant? The Trump administration has limited the number of refugees that can be resettled here. This is a program set up to help those who face serious threats to their lives in their home countries. Should the U.S. reverse the Trump administration's limitations on refugees so the United States can help more of these people?
Sure. Well, I make a distinction of people that are immigrants and people that are refugees. Those are two separate categories of class of citizens. And absolutely, if we have individuals coming from countries that are seeking asylum or as a refugee through the State Department process, absolutely, we should look at what it is that we can to help these guys in. But a lot of people try to meld those two, Peter, and saying that an immigrant is the same as a political refugee. They're not the same. And I believe that if there's a situation where somebody is coming here legitimately from a country where they fear and whatever the rules are for seeking asylum, we should be able to make sure that we're there to help those folks as well.
So should the cap be lifted? Should the Trump administration's efforts to limit the number of refugees be reversed?
I'm at a disadvantage, to be honest with you, Peter. I don't know what the cap was and where they want to go. What I do want to say is that if, in fact, there's legitimate political concerns as a refugee, that we should be there with open ears and open arms to see if we can't help those folks out.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about the blurring of lines between what is an immigrant and what is a refugee, the State Department process, there is one. There's also, or at least there used to be, a process by which someone could arrive at the border and say, I am a refugee, I need help, I am fleeing. Is that something you would support as a process for taking in refugees?
Sure. But that would be a State Department point of entry. If somebody declares themselves as a refugee and not just somebody that's trying to immigrate, I think we should have an ability to be able to put those people in whatever process that needs to be so they can be properly identified as a refugee. You bet.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about veterans health care for a moment. Veterans health care is increasingly found not at VA hospitals, but through private doctors. And this was through first the Veterans Choice Act. Now it's enabled by the Mission Act. Do you think this is the right direction for the VA? More resources for veterans seeking care outside actual VA brick and mortar hospitals?
Sure. Well, my perspective as a VA is very unique. You know, I'm a veteran. My wife's a veteran. My father's retired. My son is currently serving on active duty. My family has over 112 years of military service. So my perspective is I'm a husband, I'm a father, I'm an uncle. Absolutely. You know, a veteran, it's a debt owed. And if there's an opportunity for them to go and seek medical attention anywhere they go, that should be able to be their choice. You know, when I was growing up, when you went to medical installations at military facilities, they were full service hospitals. They were there at every installation. We've since gone from that model. And I believe now with the President's Act of the Choice Act, I believe that's something that has to be out there. Look, whatever that veteran needs, and some people still want to go to the VA system because there's a sense of brotherhood and camaraderie there. If that's what they want to do, we shouldn't limit on where a veteran needs to go. So I'm all for giving a veteran an opportunity to go and see and seek help wherever they see fit.
I want to close our conversation, Steve Negron, by asking you a question about bipartisanship. Is there an issue or a policy idea where you find common grounds with Democrats and would be willing to push with them for that issue, perhaps even against members of your own party?
Oh, absolutely. You know, just because, you know, we run as a conservative as a Republican doesn't mean that we are a rubber stamp. You know, I believe that there are some. I believe I would love to go and talk to some folks that, you know, I believe that there's Democrats that have the same fears of the debt as I do. And I would be, you know, locked arms with them trying to find good legislation, good work to be able to reduce those debts. So anything that's, first of all, is good for the state of New Hampshire and the state or the second congressional district, bipartisan or not, that's my first role, my first responsibility. And if I can work with Democrats as well, then so be it. I welcome that.
Steve Negron, thank you very much for speaking with me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Have a good day.
Steve Negron, Republican running for Congress in the primary, the Republican primary ahead of the September 8th election. You can find all our conversations with candidates running in the primary at nhpr.org. And we've got another coming up after the break, a conversation with Republican Matt Mayberry. He's hoping to face incumbent Democrat Chris Pappas in New Hampshire's 1st Congressional District. What questions do you have for him? Email us now. The address is exchange@nhpr.org or call 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Lauren Chulgin, NHPR political reporter, and we are so thankful for our members who make NHPR's news reporting possible. That includes our comprehensive coverage of the coronavirus pandemic. If you're looking for another way to help, you can donate that vehicle you no longer need to us. We'll pick up your car, truck, or RV and invest the funds right back into the programming you rely on every day. Go online to nhpr.org/cardonation to learn more. And thanks so much.
Right now, we're speaking with candidates running in the September 8th primary. Next, Matt Mayberry. He's a Republican candidate for Congress in the 1st District, a former New Hampshire GOP vice chairman. Matt Mayberry is a decorated Air Force veteran and has been active in politics, serving on the Dover City Council and in 2018 on the New Hampshire Commission for Human Rights. He was one of the Republicans hoping to challenge U.S. Congressman Chris Pappas in the general election in the fall, and your questions for him are welcome. Give us a call now. We'll bring your voice into the conversation. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And Matt Mayberry joins us now by Zoom. Thank you very much for being here.
Good morning, Peter. How are you today?
Doing well. Thank you very much. Glad to have this conversation with you. And I wanted to start with an issue that you are very familiar with, and that's the issue of the Second Amendment, because you organize gun shows, and you've said you want to expand Second Amendment rights, including removing any barriers to owning a suppressor. Now, for those of us who aren't familiar with a suppressor, can you explain what that is and why that is important to you?
Sure. Part of it is, for those who may not know, it's also called a silencer.
Okay. That's a term more people might be familiar with. Yeah.
Correct. Yes. And so what this does is allows, you know, we have gun rangers such as Major Waldron's here in Barrington. That's outside. That would just lower the noise decibel for the neighborhood and the neighbors. And I think it's part of, it's an accessory to a firearm that is protected under the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. You've said that you are a states' rights guy. Should states be allowed to regulate guns the way they want to? Or should there be a federal policy?
There should be a federal policy because it does fall under the U.S. Constitution, but in keeping with my state's rights policy, if a state passes legislation, that's up to the state. But I want to see it expanded.
Mm-hmm. And in what way would you want to see it expanded?
I'd like to see you be able to carry from Caribou, Maine to Malibu, California. I think it's part of our rights. I think that if your state allows for a constitutional concealed carry, then the other 49 states should respect your laws. And I also want, as we talked about earlier, the accessibility to accessories, such as a suppressor. And I also want to have a consistent baseline of stand your ground legislation, because Peter, right now, there are, I think, 17 different forms of stand your ground across our country. I think we need to have one standard level.
I want to ask you about racist policies in government and what, if anything, the government should do in your view. The national conversation about race, of course, is going on right now, especially given what's happened in Wisconsin. Is there a specific action you would take to combat systemic racial injustice, whether it's in housing policy or education or some other area of public concern?
Governor Chris Sununu appointed me to be chairman of the Board of Commissioners for the State of New Hampshire Commission on Against Discrimination. So I've seen it. I don't think there's systemic racism. Discrimination does happen. I'm also a realtor. So, you know, in your last segment, you talked about red line laws. We're taught in our ethics classes about discrimination and fighting against red line. So I think it's a conversation we need to have. Peter, when we get into conversations and one-on-one discussions, that's a good thing. Education is always good. When you get into looting and rioting and destroying people's property and infringing on other people's rights to quiet enjoyment, I think that's wrong. I like to see the temperature brought down a great deal and have us around the table talking about this, such as Governor Chris Sununu, bringing folks together, having a discussion and working towards it. We're not perfect. We need to get better every single day. And we will.
Mm-hmm. So on the question of systemic racism, I mean, there are many people who would disagree with you. And one of the things they would cite is the disproportionate contact that police have with Black and brown people. Is that not, in your view, an element of systemic racism?
When we talk about law enforcement, yeah, I carry a challenge coin with me every single day. My best friend is a police officer. He wears a bulletproof vest to work so you don't have to. He goes to work at 11 o'clock at night so you can stay home with your family and children. He is willing to die for us. I push back on this systemic racism that I think anytime I go back to my earlier point of education, we're bringing forward body cameras, dash cams, other things. We need to continue to educate our law enforcement, but we also need to continue to educate our community. We cannot go burning down buildings because we disagree with something that's happened in the news. We can't go looting and rioting. If you saw what happened last night when people were trying to leave the White House from the president's speech, they were accosted. A woman that we know here in New Hampshire, her name is Danielle, she was liquid thrown into her face. What if that had been acid? And she's hoping that it's water. Violence does not contribute to the conversation that we need to have moving forward.
I don't think anybody here is advocating for violence, but the question is about systemic racism, and the example I used was disproportionate contact, not just in New Hampshire, although that has been shown, but across the country. It doesn't seem like you believe that is an element of systemic racism.
You, Peter, seem to love the word systemic racism. That seems to be your favorite word this morning. I'm saying that there are incidences that happen that we need to have a conversation and get better as professions, as professionals, mm-hmm. and as citizens. And we need to keep talking and understand each other better. As Commissioner of Human Rights for the state of New Hampshire, I did that for a year and a half.
Do you support the Black Lives Matter movement?
I support having conversations about ending discrimination. I support conversations in education to end any type of discrimination. Governor Chris Sununu appointed a special attorney general for this. He appointed me commissioner of human rights for the state of New Hampshire. We're taking an active lead to rid this state of any form of discrimination.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you a little bit about the COVID-19 pandemic, since that is also big in the news lately and affecting a lot of people's lives. In Congress, what more do you think should be done to address it?
I think we need to open up our economy. I think in hindsight, when we offered the $600 bonus for unemployment, that actually caused people to stay home, Peter. They made more money staying home than they did working. And that has slowed small businesses from opening. That's hurt our economy. So I think, the government should try to get, the federal government should try to get out of this as much as we can, allow states the flexibility to work with the crisis and get our economy back up and going again.
With respect to the $600 payments, agreed. There are people out there who have said that they make more on these benefits than they would normally working. Is that not a sign that wages are too low and that something should be done to increase the amount people are paid?
Not even close. I think the PPP, when it was first introduced, it helped a lot of small businesses that needed it. It was an unfunded federal mandate when they said, you must shut down your businesses. That was wrong, and the government should help those small businesses. I have no problem with when you fund an unfunded mandate of saying, we will give you options to earn an income. But this whole Bernie Sanders, Andrew Yang, we must have a minimum wage or a minimum
universal basic income is what Andrew Yang.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I think that's wrong.
So with respect to the pandemic, I mean, do you think that that businesses should not have been forced to shut down at all?
I think businesses should have had an opportunity. They should have had a choice. When the federal government mandates that you must shut down, you're taking away people's options. We're adults. We're educated. We should continue to be educated and make educated decisions. on how we want to conduct our business and the risk that we take going forward. I wear a mask, especially when if there's a sign on the door saying, please wear a mask. We would appreciate it, of course, because it's their business, it's their options. I think it's up to you, Peter, to protect yourself and how you protect your family. And I disagree with the whole, you're not wearing it for yourself, you're wearing it to protect me. I'm an adult. I can protect myself just fine.
I think the way the argument is played out with respect to that is that, you know, you can wear a mask and still have a chance of transmitting a disease. It's not just protecting yourself, it is protecting others. I think the science has borne that out.
And there we sit.
The deficit and the national debt have risen not just because of COVID-19 relief spending, but because of tax cuts the GOP pushed through early in the president's term. The deficit and the debt is a concern among some. Is that something that you were concerned about? And if so, were the tax cuts appropriate?
Debt deficit is a huge concern of mine, Peter. But I think what happened was when we saw the tax cuts, that led to our booming economy prior to COVID. We had the lowest unemployment. We had, you know, our economy is cranking right along.
But unemployment was already low before those tax cuts. It's hard to say that one caused the other.
And it continued it. It allowed our businesses to grow and to prosper and for the middle income to rise and stabilize. And that's a good thing.
So you support the tax cuts?
I would make them permanent, Peter.
You'd make them permanent.
I'd make them permanent because that caused our economy to bloom, blossom, and grow. That sunshine that was created on there got our economy going, and COVID shut it down. And we're going to get our economy back up and going. Mm-hmm.
So if spending levels continue, even with those cuts that you want to make permanent, then the debt and the deficit are going to increase unless there are cuts that happen. Do you have any specific areas where you think cuts should be made?
I do, absolutely. I think the Federal Department of Education should be eliminated. I think it should be put a padlock on the door and let states keep their money. Going back to being a states' rights guy, I think John Sununu, Chris Sununu, Frank Edelblue, and our legislature can educate our children a whole lot better than a bureaucrat can in Washington. That will be millions upon millions of dollars saved and sent back to the states to help educate our children. I believe in school choice. I think that the money should follow the child, not the child have to go chase the money down.
Mm-hmm. Is that enough to level out the budget? Because it seems like, just my quick search here, is that it's an annual budget of $68 billion, or at least it was a couple of years ago.
Well, a billion here, a billion there, eventually you get into some real money. So it's a good start, Peter.
Listeners, if you've got questions for Matt Mayberry, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. This is not the first pandemic the world has seen, and there may be another one someday. How in Congress do you think you could help to better prepare the country for the next one?
I think we've learned a lot of lessons from this. We need to bring our supply chain back to the United States. We need to manufacture our own PPE, but also our own pharmaceuticals right here in America. We saw that firsthand. We also look at how states and individuals respond to COVID. Peter, when this came forward, I found 200 gallons of hand sanitizer that I delivered to first responders, specifically police departments, all around this state. I helped find 2,000 face masks that I delivered to the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Department. I delivered over 200 meals through the Stratford County Meals on Wheels program, because it's about neighbor checking on neighbor. I also helped find Chromebooks for low-income children so they can continue their education. It's how we as individuals, you know, I believe in personal responsibility and individual liberty. And it's people like myself who step forward and help our communities. But on a larger scale nationally, we need to bring our manufacturing of pharmaceuticals back here to American shores.
We have this question from Jerry in Dover. He wanted to follow up on the conversation we had earlier about the Second Amendment. Jerry says, using the candidate's logic of respecting the carry and conceal laws from one state in a state that does not allow it, would that mean that New Hampshire would have to respect laws such as the Massachusetts law to tax earnings in New Hampshire? I think Jerry's referring to the Massachusetts attempt to tax workers who live in New Hampshire and who used to commute to Massachusetts but haven't been commuting to Massachusetts because of the pandemic. What do you say to Jerry's comment, Matt Mayberry?
Big leap from Second Amendment to personal income tax.
Well, the idea of respecting, you know, one state's laws in a state that does not allow such a thing. So, when you're
the resident of New Hampshire, and you're spending most of your time working in New Hampshire, I agree with Governor Chris Sununu that you should not be withheld in income tax. You're here in New Hampshire, living here, working here, so you should not be paying that Massachusetts income tax. I support our governor.
I think the spirit of Jerry's question is, why have state laws at all if you know you can have a state law, but someone else can from another state can come into your state and break it with impunity? Is that fair? I think that's Jerry's question, or the spirit of it, at least.
I just think that if you live in New Hampshire, you shouldn't have to pay a Massachusetts income tax if you're working in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm. Let's ask about immigration, because you've said that you disagree with the family separation policy, saying it was bad for the parents and the children. What specific policy changes in immigration would you like to see?
Absolutely. First of all, I would outlaw or ban sanctuary cities. We have 368 sanctuary cities, and if I had my way, they would get zero federal funding. We shouldn't pay you to break the law.
Oh, they're as far as I understand, though, they're not breaking the law. They're just not holding someone without documentation who has not committed a serious crime. And the federal courts have affirmed that that's the right thing to do. It's unconstitutional to detain someone like that for longer.
When you're breaking the law and a municipality is assisting in harboring that criminal, because you are breaking the law, no matter which way you look at it, Peter.
Well, it's not a crime. It's a civil violation, and they can't hold them for civil violations. It's a civil violation to not have paperwork. It's not a crime.
It's still breaking the law.
So you would outlaw sanctuary cities and deny them funding. Is there any other changes to immigration policy that you would like to make?
I would. I would actually take President Trump's done a good job of building the wall 15 feet high. I would continue it 15 feet below ground, so you can't tunnel in. I like Congressman Will Hurd's thought of that. We have open desert, you have sensors, and you use drone technology to patrol those borders. We need and we must strengthen our borders.
For the sake of immigration.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Illegal immigration.
Illegal immigration.
I do favor the expansion and stabilization of the H-1A, H-1B, H-2A, and H-2B visas, because that helps New Hampshire with our economy. We derive $5 billion of our economy comes from tourism. We need to have foreign guest workers come and help our restaurants, our hotels, our tourist attractions. That is part of our economy. Exporting from New Hampshire is a $5.8 billion industry. I want to see that extended over $6 billion, but we often need people with specific technical and scientific expertise to come into New Hampshire, help our companies grow, help our exports grow, and keep our economy growing. So I do believe in legal immigration. I do believe in guest worker visa programs. I've seen it work. I've heard from small businesses, and it works for them.
What about refugees? As we spoke about with Steve Negron earlier, the Trump administration has reduced the number of refugees allowed to find safe harbor in the United States. Should that be reversed? Should more refugees be allowed to come to the United States in search of safety for themselves and their families?
Each law and regulation should continuously be reviewed. I believe in God. I believe in the power of prayer. I think when people come to the border and they're escaping religious persecution, that should be looked at. It should be fast-tracked and decide pretty quickly whether it's a genuine refugee situation in which they're escaping for their lives or from religious persecution, or they're just trying to get into the country faster through legal immigration. Mm-hmm. But I do think refugees should be looked at. I think any policy should be reviewed. If it's effective, great. If not, how do you tweak it to make it more effective for all those who are served and being served by it?
Let's go to the phones and talk to Jen and Keen. Jen, thank you very much for calling. What's your question?
Hi. I'm getting very disconcerted here. I'm hearing all this advocacy for the individual parts of things, individual states' rights, individual, a lot of things. And, you know, what happens when the individual of one thing outweighs the others, whether it's education or healthcare? I'm a person with cancer and a whole bunch of things, a minority religion, as you're talking about religion right now. And, you know, there are so many religions, so many different healthcare options. My understanding is part of what makes America great is that the sum of our parts are greater as a whole. Is that something that, as a states' right and, you know, advocate for all these individual parts, you know, you tend to put one part ahead of others if you pick, you know, states' rights or individual rights, then you drown out the other parts. That's part of why we're having so much struggle with diversity and things. Does this not weigh in with this states' right thing? Like, what happens with healthcare and religion if we don't have a sum of the parts take on it, when we don't come at it as a more unified whole?
So, Jen, your question about unity as well as states' rights, I'll put it to Matt Mayberry.
And Jen, thank you for the question. We had our 90-day experiment with socialism. We were told when to go outside, what to wear when we go outside, when you shall shop, when you shall work, when you shall educate your children, all dictated by the government. And I think we had a very systemic pushback on that. I do believe in personal responsibility. I do believe in individual liberty. And as you mentioned in your own comments, Jen, that there are choices and there are options that you as an individual have. It's not the government telling you, this is where you shall get your healthcare. This is where you shall work. This is not the universal paycheck. This is exactly how much you shall make. No, this is America. This is land of the free and home of the brave. You as an individual have those options. You have those choices. You make it every single day. I want to expand that. I want to grow our economy. I want those small businesses to thrive. I want your children to have choices in education so they can get the very best start in life. I am so excited for what's coming forward. We are a great country. America does hard things well. Here in New Hampshire, we're made of granite. We're resilient. We're going to come back better, stronger, more educated. We have challenges in our society every single day that we need to get better. We're not perfect. And I think when we work together, we will do that.
I wanted to follow up on something you just said there. Broadly speaking, does the government have a role in managing a public health crisis?
Of course, it's to help make sure that, you know, we get the PPE, that we get our pharmaceuticals back here, that we incentivize companies. If President Trump didn't mandate that certain companies swap over their manufacturing to ventilators, where would it be right now? There is a role. There's also a role of disseminating uniform information to everyone, but there is a role for the federal government.
Mm-hmm. I'll ask you a question about bipartisanship. You may have heard this question before, but what policy issues, if any, do you think you would find common ground with Democrats and be willing to push with them, perhaps against members of your own party?
Peter, two come right up to mind. I live in Dover, and so I'm very concerned about the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard and those 7,300 jobs right there. Shelley Pingree, who's in Maine, should she be reelected, is a Democrat. I'd work with her to protect those jobs at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard. I'm also very concerned about our very small fishing fleet here in New Hampshire. I think we're now down to 7 or 8 boats. I've been here for 35 years working with the people of New Hampshire. My opponent in the primary moved here in January, and 3 weeks after he moved here, filed for office. I'm the New Hampshire guy. I'm not the carpetbagger. I will fight for that fishing industry. I'll fight alongside any Democrat, any Republican that want to protect those jobs. I didn't move here from Washington as part of my resume. I moved here because I found veterans who were losing their access to mental health care. That's what got me engaged. There's $134 million of unpaid medical bills from the VA, and Congressman Pappas is chairman of the Oversight and Investigations Committee of the VA. He failed us, Peter. That's why I'm running. We need someone who can do a better job. We actually need someone who will actually fight for New Hampshire and not just talk about it. This, you know, we're drowning in red tape, and the Democrats are just shoving more on top of us every single day. And that's wrong.
Republican Matt Mayberry, running for the 1st Congressional District as a Republican in the primary on September 8th. Thank you very much for speaking with me. Really appreciate it.
Peter, thank you for the opportunity today. And please go to MayberryForCongress.com to learn more.
We've got a little more of the program to bring to you after a quick break. Still to come, how one very average New Hampshire strip mall is riding out the pandemic. Reminder, too, that you can hear all of the conversations that we've had with primary candidates in this series at nhpr.org. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. When we think about the health of the economy, we tend to think big. All the buying and selling, corporations, foreign trade, GDP. But if you zoom in, the economy's health can also be viewed through something much smaller, like a neighborhood or a main street or even the humble strip mall. NHPR's Todd Bookman reports from the Skyline Mall in Merrimack, where he went to see how the pandemic is reshaping this small slice of the economy.
Think of the Skyline Mall as kind of like the economic version of a potluck dinner. A little bit of everything, all crammed onto one table.
A lot of things are covered. You can do a lot of things in one day here.
This is Tom Carosa, owner of Carosa Eye Care, which sits near the middle of the Skyline's 9 storefronts. His neighbors include a physical therapist and a pizzeria, an H&R Block, a vape shop, a nail salon, a laundromat. The Skyline is even home to a medical marijuana dispensary. It's that little bit of everything quality that makes the Skyline as good a place as any to get a sense of how businesses are faring right now. Tom Carosa chose this location for his eyeglass shop for its visibility, someplace lots of cars would drive past.
5:30, 6 o'clock on a weekday, the northbound traffic is a parking lot out here, so someone's sitting around just glancing around, you know, it's kind of free publicity, free advertising.
But with less commuters during the pandemic, that's fewer potential new customers. Carosa, who learned optometry in the Army, shut down for 4 weeks this spring. He looked into federal aid programs and other state grant funds, but ultimately decided not to apply. Some of his creditors worked with him on outstanding bills. Others demanded payment. This summer, there have been good stretches of business and a few very quiet days. This fall, he's not sure what to expect.
I don't know. I don't really know what's going to happen, but it definitely seems like, you know, based off of some other areas in the country, that something could start to pick back up. And if that happens, I'll roll with it. I don't see myself closing again because now we have a lot of safety thing guidelines established.
While you're waiting for Tom Carosa to finish making your glasses, take a walk up to the northern end of the Skyline Mall and grab yourself a slice.
My name is Eduardo Rivera. I purchased Billy's Famous Pizza this February. It was a very good opportunity. I always wanted to own something for myself, so I figured this would be a good start.
Rivera has 20 years in the restaurant industry. He waited and researched and then finally bought a business of his own, a classic pizzeria with slices and specialty pies on the menu. Rivera recommends the Meat Lovers.
Meat Lovers, you get sausage, pepperoni, ham, bacon, ground hamburger, and salami. I'm a big guy, so I need some protein.
Rivera purchased the pizzeria just a few weeks before the pandemic took hold. He initially turned off his ovens for 2 weeks, but then he ramped back up, focusing on takeout and delivery. He received federal PPP relief funds and didn't lay off any workers. In fact, he's had trouble finding line cooks. Rivera has noticed that as the number of cars pulling into shop at other businesses in the plaza has started to return to normal, he's also seen more walk-in customers.
There's a connection of a business if everybody's doing well. Obviously, if there's more flow of people, you're going to get some business from it.
Every business in this strip mall has reopened since the shutdown or never closed. On a sunny Monday, there's someone getting a manicure at the number one nail salon. A guy hauls a basket of clothes into the streams of water laundromat. The Godfrey Family Carpet Store has a sign up asking people to call to make an appointment. Continue walking under the blue and white awning, and you'll come to Big Kahuna's Restaurant, a kind of island-themed, laid-back, local food place right in the center of the skyline. In the kitchen, Big Kahuna's co-owner, Amanda Spooner, is grilling chicken and preparing kale. Lots of kale.
We go through so much kale. It's something special about Kahuna kale. Everybody loves it, and we can't quite put our finger on why. It's just different. People can't duplicate it. So people get sides of it, and you never see somebody eat so much kale. They'll get the bowl with the kale and a side of kale.
Amanda's husband, JP, is an easygoing guy who spent time in Hawaii. He sits at one of the tables and describes the first few days of the shutdown like this.
We were open, just nobody showed up. And that was pretty traumatic.
But since then, his delivery orders have taken off. A few employees weren't comfortable coming back to work, but he was able to hire some new folks. JP has tried to turn Big Kahuna's into what he calls an oasis of normalcy. Keep the menu and the ingredients bright. Keep the energy positive. Keep your staff happy. He tries to spread that spirit throughout the strip mall, with the nail salon owner, with Eduardo at the pizza shop, the cannabis dispensary workers. They definitely get it.
Because if we are in this little tiny plaza, and this isn't one of these multi-million dollar, gigantic, super attractive places to look at, it's a plaza in the middle of Merrimack. But the magic happens once you get out of your car and you come into one of these businesses and you get to say to yourself, well, wasn't expecting that.
The Skyline Mall is its own little micro economy right now. Each business is on its own, but each one is connected. Todd Bookman, NHPR News.
And that is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup for this week. The show's producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brinley is our program director. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Jane Vaughn is the production fellow for The Exchange, and our regular theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.